You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Monster House presents.
Hey there, Monster Talkers. I recently started a project to collect all the books we've discussed on Monster Talk into one useful, sortable data table. The Monster Talk Library Project will always be a work in progress so long as we're making new episodes, but you can go in and search the list and sort by title and author and find the associated episode along with links to the actual books. I've made it an easy, short URL to get to it. You can just go to bit.ly/monstertalkbooks. That's all one word, all lowercase, bit.ly/monstertalkbooks. And there's also a link to it at the top of our website at monstertalk.org. Thanks to everyone who has suggested this idea over the years. I always thought it was a good idea, and I'm excited to actually have it working for you. Monster Talk is an independent podcast production of Monster House, LLC. You can show your support by subscribing to our ad-free extended episodes at patreon.com/monstertalk. We want to grow our Monster Talk audience, and the easiest way to accomplish that is for listeners to leave us 5-star reviews on iTunes. Positive reviews have a huge impact and only take a moment.
Staffordshire's had a whole crop of flying saucers. Spots in the sky, lights in the sky, strange things. But the strangest of all was seen one day over this cottage. Mr. and Mrs. Rustenberg were living there, quietly, out in the country. And, well, what, you just tell me what you saw.
Well, it was one ordinary day. I was waiting for my husband to come home from work, and my two sons went to Cyford to school, and I was getting changed, and I heard this terrific noise. It was just like a giant cauldron of water being poured onto a fire, a shh sort of noise, you know. And my first reaction was, oh, the children. I thought maybe a plane was crashing or something like that. And I slipped my jumper on and went outside to find my two sons lying flat on the ground in the garden in front of the house, shouting, "Mummy, Mummy, there's a flying saucer." Well, naturally, I just said, "Come on, don't be stupid."
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
When we recently covered the Usborne Children's Book of Ghosts, we had the opportunity to also talk about one of their other World of the Unknown series books, UFOs. And what follows is a very unusual episode of Monster Talk because the representative we got to speak to isn't the author of the book, but is actually a super fan who still has his copy from the 1970s. He's entertainer, amateur astronomer, comedian, and impressionist John Culshaw. He's been on TV and radio extensively, notably on the BBC series Dead Ringers and the continuing radio adventures of Doctor Who. So what follows is a wistful look back at the less conspiratorial UFO world of the 1970s, with half a dozen additional voices joining us along the way. Like their Ghosts book, the Usborne UFO book is gorgeously illustrated and provides a sense of wonder and delight as it explores exciting UFO cases. As is often the case, Karen and I are so skeptical of most UFO reports and their possible extraterrestrial implications that sometimes we can forget what it's like to just have that open-eyed wonder of children. John was so enthusiastic and exuberant that it was hard not to find his attitude infectious. Likewise, the Usborne book's open-minded tone and wonderful illustrations don't come down too hard on whether they think UFOs are real or fake or terrestrial or extraterrestrial, but they do make you want to learn more about the universe and our place in it. And I really do plan to do one of the experiments we talk about in the book if I can manage it, and I'll post my results. A quick note, Karen and I are planning to do another Monster Talk Live on Sunday, April 4th, so keep an eye out for that because we're going to be talking about vampire cases. And I don't know the one Karen's covering, but the one I'm going to be talking about is so weird and cinematic that I'm still shocked nobody's made a movie about it. Also, Patreon supporters will notice that I've dropped a new episode of our miniseries Big Footage, in which I cover the 1976 film Sasquatch, The Legend of Bigfoot. And while doing research for that, I ran across some really interesting stuff related to the Patterson film that we will be covering on a regular episode of Monster Talk coming up soon. I'm pretty excited about that because finding out new information about the PGF at this point felt really weird. One more thing. We do ask at one point what happened to the original author of the Usborne UFO books. While checking to see what happened to Ted Wilding White, I did come across a couple of articles that he wrote back in the 1970s. He wrote about space and space-related businesses for the newspapers at the time, and he also wrote Jane's Pocketbook of Space Exploration. I've attached a couple of PDFs to the show notes if you're interested in looking at his writing from the 1970s. He turned out to be alive, but chose not to participate in the promotion of this reissue. So at the time of this recording, he's alive and well, but declined to participate in the media for this reissue. But we wish him well. But now, let's look to the skies and get ready as we join John Culshaw and several incarnations of the Doctor to discuss the Usborne children's book, UFOs.
Monster Talk.
Hello there.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, hello. At last, I've taken a step forward into a larger world.
Yes.
Well, nice to meet you. My name's Karen.
Hello, this is John here.
Hello, and I'm Blake.
Lovely to talk to you all. Thank you, Blake. Thank you.
So it's nice to have you on. I've been watching your YouTube videos this morning.
Oh, thank you very much. Yes, quite a lot of fun over the years as the interesting characters come and go.
I know you're at least what I would call UK famous. What, how would I introduce you to the American audience?
Well, on the shows that I've impersonated a lot of presidents over the years. George Bush Senior, Junior. We love the American characters. We really, really do.
I'm from Australia originally, but I've been living here in the States for about 16 years. So, you know, often we get a lot more exposure to English personalities and politicians and characters. And so I might be more familiar with some of your stuff.
If ever I spontaneously take on a character voice, I'll make sure it's a sort of a global one. You know, maybe Ozzy Osbourne.
Perfect.
That's a good one. Yeah.
Ozzy would be great. I bought George Lucas's house, you know, and I think it was haunted, but I think I freaked all the ghosts out. I don't think they're there anymore.
I don't know how much you know about ghosts and haunted things, but we've talked about it on the show, Robert the Doll. and this cursed doll that's or supposedly cursed doll that is in Florida. And I guess he's on a new series they're doing with Ozzy and Jack, looking at different stuff. They're doing a cursed item episode.
So, really?
Yeah. By the way, we saw Robert the Doll over the holiday Christmas, and we did not ask permission. You're supposed to ask permission before you get your photo, and we didn't. And obviously, now everybody's suffering for it. My bad.
Blake is to blame.
It's such a fascinating thing. Ghosts have always fascinated me. I can't wait for the time. It's probably going to be in about 60 years or something like that when science will have figured out what's going on. What sort of unmeasurable wavelengths that we are out of our reach at the moment that are driving it.
That's very hopeful.
Yeah, I like the idea that you think science will be going in 60 years. That's great. That's the level of optimism we need today.
we also know that you are fascinated with UFOs, which is why we've brought you on the show today.
I know. Once again, I would. I've never actually seen one. It remains a great ambition of mine to see one. But I've always found them mystical. I've always found them fascinating. I think they contribute to giving the world a sense of wonder. And when you really look at those cases, especially the really bewildering ones, that very small percent that we really cannot explain, they are just so spellbinding. And perhaps they do give a clue as to a time in the future, decades, who knows, hundreds of years from now, when the human race is part of a galactic community where we know what the other civilizations are and we've earned the right to interact with them. They might just leave us be for the moment. The human response collectively might just be a little bit unwieldy and unpredictable. I think they might leave us for another 100 years or so, or just interact very subtly. But what a fascinating subject. And ever since I was a small boy, I've been gripped by the subject of UFOs.
So, John, we had Christopher Maynard on a couple of weeks ago, and we interviewed him in regards to the world of the unknown ghosts. And so we've brought you on the show today to talk about the world of the unknown, the Usborne or Usborne. I think Blake was wanting to know how you would pronounce that in the UK too. Is it Usborne or Usborne?
Yes, that's Usborne.
Usborne, okay.
A little bit like Usborne, as like Ozzy. Usborne, but with a letter U, Usborne.
So we brought you on the show to talk about the world of the unknown UFOs. And so to begin with, could you tell us a little bit about, because you wrote the foreword for the 2020 version of this book, could you tell us a little bit about your association with the book?
Yes, I bought this book for myself for the first time in 1977 when I was 9 years old. It was one of those that you were just drawn to. In this era, I loved programs such as Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World, The Unexplained magazine, a wonderful BBC documentary called Out of This World, presented by a very sort of enigmatic reporter called Hugh Burnett, with fascinating interviews with fabulous UFO experts such as Gordon Crichton. And I was fascinated in this world. And I spotted the book, and I always kept it with me. I bought it for about 25 pence in 1977. And it was sort of a Bible to me, really. I kept it with me all of the time, a handbook in case I ever saw a UFO. I would wander out into the garden or some of the nearby farmers' fields and country tracks, especially on clear days, and I would scan the skies hoping to see a UFO. So far, I never have, but in case I did, I always kept this book with me so I could look something up rather quickly or check the details off, check it against what I may have seen. I'm still doing that now, actually. It remains my greatest ambition to see a really good UFO.
It's a surprisingly comprehensive book. It really covers quite a breadth of information. And the funny thing is, to me, I mean, this book came out in 77, but there's a few big cases that have come out since then, but a lot of the material in here is the same sort of thing you would still see if you watch a current UFO program.
It is, yeah.
Yes, it really is. These stories have stayed relevant, and they are just as bewildering now, perhaps some of them even more bewildering. But I did always appreciate the way that this book was written. It credited its young readers with a good sense of inquisitiveness.
Yes.
And a good sense of intelligence. It never patronized. And it encouraged you to go out and discover things for yourself. Always written with a sense of scientific plausibility. It was never too far-fetched or outrageous. There was always a very reassuring attitude to the writing, which was, okay, well, this is what we're seeing. This is how it appears. Let's take the information we do have and let's consider what this could be. What could be going on here? And I loved the tone that they struck in doing that.
Yeah, it did remind me very much of the same tone as the Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World, where he's a skeptical guy, but he's open to testing and checking these things out. And, you know, he doesn't dismiss people out of hand.
No, he doesn't. You trusted so much what was coming from him. He was such a superb person to examine this subject. And his view on it was something that was very valuable. You really took it seriously. And the UFOs episode of Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World, I can remember him saying, I have been lucky to see several good ones. Many yes. can be explained, but the 3% that cannot are truly bewildering. He approached it with such an attitude of solidity, if you like, that mm-hmm. just added to the fascination.
So, John, you haven't seen a UFO before, and you've said that you would love to see one. So would you classify yourself as a believer or skeptic when it comes to UFOs?
I'm an absolute believer. I absolutely believe that there are alien civilizations out there in the galaxy and in the wider universe. The odds to say otherwise seem absurd when we consider the building blocks of life just as we know it: hydrogen, oxygen, carbon. These are some of the most common elements and compounds in the universe. The building blocks of life are everywhere. And I'm quite sure that life is probably more of an inevitability than a possibility. And some civilizations will be many millions of years older than our own. And I can perfectly imagine them just casually observing, but perhaps not interacting with the human race just yet. I suspect we're not quite ready. As I often imagine, I'm sure an intelligent alien race would consider human beings and their reaction en masse to be perhaps a little bit unwieldy at the moment and a little unpredictable.
They would be saying, my goodness, they haven't even figured out ghosts yet.
Ready in another 60 years.
But yes, I think it will be a wonderful moment when that is put beyond doubt, that life exists elsewhere in the universe. And I would hope that it would happen in that glorious close encounters of the third kind of way. I that's something I'd love to witness. But I suspect it may be far more steady in the way that it comes in. I think perhaps the presence of microbes in the Venusian atmosphere with the phosphine discovery recently, perhaps that's just the start. Maybe more water discovered on Mars, microbes. It might be a gentle thing. Once we can establish beyond doubt that, yes, life, even simple life, took hold independently on another planet other than the Earth, once we know that, we can extrapolate, I think, with a lot more certainty that life can take hold anywhere in the universe. We're edging towards that, I think.
I think so, too. In these cases that they cover in the book, which again they cover the idea of the close encounter model from J. Allen Hynek, and then there's cases in here that are at least, well, all through the classic three kinds. Now I think the close encounters scale has been extended by other authors to the fourth kind, but I think the lights in the sky, the seeing a craft, and the actually seeing aliens. All those kind of cases are covered in the book. Were there cases that you read about that were particularly significant to you or really that still haunt you today or you find compelling?
Oh, yes, indeed. I love the tale of the Hopkinsville goblins.
Me too.
It's a favorite.
they are wonderful, wonderful creatures. I wonder if they were creatures that were helping another civilization. Maybe they were the scouts just going out to take a look. And in the book, in the Osborne UFOs book, there is a page which explores what their home planet might look like given their appearance, the large eyes and the ears, what sort of conditions on a planet would require you to have those. So that was a wonderful feature that inspired a column I wrote for Sky at Night magazine over in the UK for 6 years called Exoplanet Excursions. This was where we take the details that we know of confirmed exoplanets and we try to imagine what the conditions might be like if you were physically there or physically able to observe it in some detail. So I love the Hopkinsville goblins. There was another story about an alien encounter which was in a Renault car factory in Argentina in 1972. And these creatures were very haunting-looking creatures indeed, very tall, 7 foot in height, with pale silvery skin, piercing eyes, seen in the sort of washroom areas of a car factory at night. You know, just imagine walking around the corner and stumbling into something like that. These give you... It's like a scene from Doctor Who or Quatermass. It's fascinating, wonderful stuff. You put yourself in that position. If you came face-to-face with a situation just like that, how would you feel? How would you react? It's the sort of fear you rather enjoy.
Would it be presumptuous to ask you about the artwork in the book, but to answer in the voice of Tom Baker?
Oh, yes, exactly. I mean, many of the depicted in Osborne World of the Unknown UFOs were very much like some of the blueprints that Philip Hinchcliffe would draw for adventures in Doctor Who, the world of Sutek, and the area where the Zygons occupied. Many of these were broadly similar. It's no
very
surprise.
You are killing me. That is fantastic.
Oh, if I attempted to speak like that the whole time.
I would. Yeah.
If you could, yeah.
Well, exactly. Exactly.
So, John, you mentioned that you had a column in an astronomy magazine. Could you tell us a little bit more about your interest in astronomy?
Yes, I love that Carl Sagan, he said that astronomy is a very humbling and character-building, which it really is. The way that astronomy, it's very good for the soul, and it connects you to the ecosystems across the solar system and galaxy that we are part of. And it's so good to just experience that and feel that. And to observe Jupiter through binoculars, simply see the little four dots of light, which are the Galilean moons, to look at Saturn through a telescope and see the rings and know that that is the real object that you're seeing. It's not just a diagram. And just to contemplate what is out there, what we don't know, what we can't possibly know. And the mystery of the universe. And astronomy is a wonderful way to take you forwards to that. I'm utterly fascinated by exoplanets and just how utterly different they could be to what we're familiar with on Earth. Maybe in some cases, how similar. And what a joy it would be, what a fascination to be able to actually visit these worlds. I wonder what year it will be when human beings can actually travel to some of these Kepler planets to 55 Cancri E, to the TRAPPIST system, and witness neighbouring planets in a similar way to how we see our own moon in our own sky. These alien vistas, these alien worlds, these alien visions. You just want to step into a TARDIS and observe them. Yes, I want to see it. The Master wants to conquer it, but I just want to observe it.
I just want to escape to Barnard's Star before the Vogon Constructor Fleet gets here. So as an astronomer or as an amateur astronomer, I've often heard it said that the reason amateur astronomers don't spot a lot of UFOs is that they're very good at figuring out what things are. Is that tracked to your experience?
Yes, I think it probably does. Very often you might see a satellite or an iridium flare, which might just get you going for a few moments full of hope. Maybe this is the moment. But then, yeah. Oh yes, it's a satellite. It's something else. But it's nice just to hold on to that frisson just for a few moments. That's why those UFO cases that the astronomers and the likes of Arthur C. Clarke cannot explain. That's why they are so wonderful and valuable. The astronomers who don't have those answers to certain cases, those are the real intriguing ones.
Well, I love the double-page spread in the book about mistaken identity that goes into a lot of UFO reports and just natural explanations, things like parachutes or balloons or even ball lightning. It covers a lot of different natural phenomena.
Yes, the effect of spotlights, searchlights, ball lightning, that's another fascinating topic altogether. The planet Venus, another one. That's a very useful thing in the book to just check against. If you do have a sighting of your own, it's very useful to be able to just tick those off the list. And it's quite nice that they did look into that area as well, those that can be faked or those that fool us or those which are really quite ordinary. Important to have that balance in there, I think. A very useful couple of pages there.
No, quite. I was, as an American skeptic, though, I was disappointed because I thought everything was swamp gas, and there's not a word about swamp gas in here.
I think that's just in the opening moments of a sci-fi scene, just to set the mystery, you know.
Yeah.
I emphasize in conclusion that I cannot prove in a court of law that marsh gas is the full explanation of these sightings. But it does appear to me extremely likely. And furthermore, I must read to back this point up. I am, after all, an astronomer and not a chemist.
Did you notice, I had actually forgotten this, but as you're reading through, you might be like me and you're drawn to the stories of UFOs and aliens, but there's a surprising amount of arts and crafts in this book. there's a pyramid power experiment to build your own pyramid and try to preserve bacon, which I have to say, I have all the things I need to do that experiment. And also there's a build your own UFO. So I believe I'm going to try to do both of those, and I'll post a video of my results. But I don't know what my wife will think, but I'm going to try. I have never actually done a practical experiment on pyramid power. You know, being very skeptical, I don't believe in it. But given the opportunity to make a little paper pyramid and put some bacon in my garage and let it go rancid, how could I pass that up? But
exactly. It's always nice to set about a task that will eventually result in somebody saying to you, "What are you doing?"
Exactly. Which is literally the basis for my marriage.
It's a daily thing in his household. Yeah.
That's a lovely aspect in the book. Part of inspiring the young readers and sending them off on a path to make their own discoveries in this area of the phenomena. To be set a task like that is a step along the way to making your own discoveries. So, yes, nice that it was such an amusing way to do that.
Yeah, I think I was about 6 or 7 when I came across this book first. And, I think it's suitable for kids as young as that age through to us adults.
Yes, it really is. It's amazing how reading the book again now, and the tone doesn't seem overly childlike at all. You can read it perfectly comfortably with your adult brain. It's not patronizing. It's not written in any kind of, as if it's to a primary school student. Yeah, but that tone is pretty succinct and crisp. Mm-hmm. And yes, it doesn't feel out of place to look at it with your grown-up head on.
No. Yeah. I think, in fact, it's got such a lovely mix of science and mystery that it's the kind of thing that would prompt a kid to really want to investigate more and on their own, and like to leave those things. It's open to investigation. This is not a closed answer book. This is an open answer book. But I'm curious, though, how did you end up becoming a spokesperson for this book republishing?
The very quick action of social media. I noticed it on, I noticed that the Ghosts edition had been reissued, And the brilliant Rhys Shearsmith had written the foreword there. And I posted a photograph of my own copy of the UFOs book in response to Anna Powers, who did so much to get these back on. And she replied very quickly, said, well, yes, we shall see what we can do there. We shall follow on that. And that led to me being asked to write the foreword. That gave away that I'd had my copy of this book when I was a lad in 1977. And I was 9 years old, and that I still looked at it now. I still had my copy. So, yes, I was invited to write the foreword, which I was very honored to do.
That's nice. I assume you did not cut out the pyramid from your old copy. What?
No, I just, after us having talked about it, I think I might give that a go. Or I might just leave the bacon in the refrigerator. I might just leave it there. But
yeah, or eat it.
Try.
So you still have the same copy that you had as a child?
I do. It's a little dog-eared and a little worn out, but it's quite nice to have it next to the new edition. And back in those days, in 1977, 78, I could have had no idea at all that my favourite book would have a regeneration and I'd be asked to write the foreword for it. I don't think my 9-year-old self would ever have believed that.
That's wild.
Go
ahead. Sorry, Karen.
I was just going to say, I had my original copy is long gone. I had some of the other Osborne series too, for the haunted houses and vampires. And I found that the pages fell out. So with the glue didn't keep the pages in. So over the years, I just read them so many times that they fell apart.
Yeah, isn't that the greatest tribute you can have to a book, that you read it so often over and over again that it actually wore out and fell to bits?
Yes, absolutely.
That's the ambition of every book, I am sure, to be read and cherished to that extent. I think that's a very glorious thing for a book.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Because the way you were describing it in there, it does evoke that feeling that every time you look at the book, you think about certain topics in a different way. You have a different slant on it. Your imagination might come up with a different thing. It might spark a different thought. So no wonder you keep on going back, because it just keeps you thinking. It keeps your mind active. It keeps you asking all of those questions. And you think of it a different way each time.
The Kelly Hopkinsville Goblins case was one that also really it stuck in my mind. And I did like a 3-episode deep dive into the history of the case. And I realized when I was looking at some of the material for the case that there, at the time of the report, there were a lot of skeptics saying, based on the evidence that was at the site, that they thought it might have been made up because the holes in the screen window were not consistent with what they thought would happen if someone fired a 20-gauge shotgun or 22 rifle through the screen. And a little bit more than a year ago, I realized that I had in my possession a screen, a 20-gauge shotgun, and a 22 rifle.
As so you do.
Being from the United States, of course, I mean, that's like mandatory. It's, you know. Anyway, I went out and did an experiment, and I haven't published my findings, but I can tell you that my findings were that the holes that I produced with those weapons were completely consistent with what the people in Kentucky reported. So whether or not there were really aliens there or not, I'm confident they really did shoot through the screens with the weapons described. So I think that's kind of fun.
Yes, it was described that the sound that the bullets made sounded like they were being fired into a bucket.
Yes,
I think it was a description.
It's a peculiar case. It really is. I think the one thing that I find interesting is if you look at the old photos of the farm, the only outside lights was a single bulb hanging off the porch. So it was really poorly illuminated. But I got the impression that it was an extremely frightening experience. Like, even though I'm very skeptical about it being aliens, I think they really did see something peculiar that night. And really did fire a lot of gunfire and really were terrified, really did go get the cops. And I think the people whatever they saw, they absolutely experienced something that they would never experience again. It was a one-time, very peculiar event.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those reactions really did seem to be utterly genuine. This was absolute terror, absolute fear, as you would have in such circumstances. But they weren't simply people making up a story or seeking notoriety. It was the polar opposite of that. This was a very bewildering, terrifying experience.
Absolutely. Oh, you know what? I'll self-plug here. We'll put a link to our previous episodes in the show notes. So if you're coming to this episode and haven't heard that before, you can hop on over there and check those out.
So looking at the credits, it says it was written by Ted Wilding White. What happened to Ted? What's the story about Ted?
Well, I don't know, but we're very thankful to him. We are very, very thankful to him. And yes, I must look that up, actually. I must look that up.
Yeah, I just was curious to find out what his story is with the book and how he came to write the book and what's happened to him and if he's written any other books about UFOs. Because it seems like there's a very large group of people who were involved in consultancy and additional writing and illustration.
Mm-hmm.
But, just never actually heard of Ted, whereas Chris is very well connected to the Ghosts version. And we're curious about the author.
Yes, that would be good to know. That would be very good to know. That should be part of my homework to go and do some research there. I shall go and find out. But yes, we're very grateful to him, obviously. That goes without saying.
Oh, yeah. And the art is, I think with all the Osborne books, the art is one of the most impressive parts, but I just they're paintings, but some of them are almost photorealistic, and they are so evocative, and they just especially like what would you call that, hypothetical aliens, these sort of like astrobiology sections, like it's just so interesting.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
The way these pieces come together, and they almost look like photographs, and they do have the ability to put photographs in here. There's sections in there where are photographs, but they also, they've just done these lovely painstaking paintings, and I think it really makes the books amazing. You've got the cover of the book has your picture on it now because I got the reprint, but it's got...
Yes, it's lovely to know what I'd look like if I was a postage stamp.
Yeah,
with a UFO in the background.
Exactly. It's got this the Georgia Damski. I think people sometimes call it the lampshade UFO, but it's got these sort of flying saucers rendered as though real physical aircraft. They look great.
Very classic. Yeah. Classic ones. Yeah.
You know, they remind me of the "I Want to Believe" poster on the X-Files.
Oh yes. Yeah.
Yes. There is something about those illustrations, exactly as you described. They're rather beautiful. The artistic nature of them is a very beautiful thing. It was pleasing to look at, and it gave the books that strong identity. It was part of their identity. And pleasing when you're a child to look at those kind of illustrations that have that vibrancy that just pays into your imagination and keeps you with it. And alongside the photographs and the diagrams, it's a lovely part of the identity of it there.
And in looking at the credits too, there were 8 illustrators, so that's quite a team of people working on this.
Yes, you can just imagine them there in their studio, doing all of the experimental preparatory studies and creating all of those images. Interestingly, I've never seen a UFO. My elder brother, Jim, he and his family did see a fantastic UFO. And my brother is a very level-headed, logical-thinking engineer. And this back in 2009, one of those sort of, they were almost jellyfish UFOs, hovered over their home in Ormskirk, Lancashire. A huge thing. It seemed to be about the size of a football stadium above them. Whenever he describes it, the sense of how mysterious and bewildering it was to him with a logical engineer's mind, he described the sections rather being like a citrus fruit, like an orange. Yeah. In the centre of it, there was almost like a molten area that was swirling around, far, far, far too big to be any kind of Chinese lantern or a hot air balloon. And there was quite a lot of these types of craft described around about the 2009 period. So I don't know if anybody's ever seen anything similar to that. I think I sent across some of his descriptions of it. It might be useful at another time. But that was a very, very strange incident that he described.
Almost everything in here is talking about a material phenomena that is, you know, probably an extraterrestrial hypothesis, right? So, but I think in the world of ufology, there's been some interesting splits from the, and I guess this actually goes back to like Jacques Vallée, but you've got the people who go, well, that's one possible cause of this. And another might be, what if these are from another dimension? And, you know, are they perhaps supernatural in some way? You know, I think my mom always thought they were demonic, you know, bless your heart. So, but
that's a wonderful story, though. That's really good fun.
He and his wife and son witnessed it, and they are mystified as to why nobody else in the town saw this. It seems to be hugely unreported and a thoroughly strange thing. There's one diagram in the Osborne book which is the most similar thing to what they saw, where there was a sort of a central part which is where all the what appeared to be molten activity was going on, and this enormous shell around it where you could see inside this. And scorch marks were visible.
Oh.
But clearly it was not any kind of hot air balloon, any kind of Chinese lantern, far, far, far too big for that. The only thing I could ever think of describing it as, from what I've heard, you have to go to some Doctor Who plot. I'll have to borrow the voice of Tom Baker. Yes, an enormous organic creature. You find these, they live in the atmosphere of super-Earths. Almost like an amoeba, and digesting some of the that kind of plankton that exists in the very thick atmospheres of super-Earths. Sometimes they can cross from one other dimension into another, just have a quick exploratory flight in the planet Earth, rather like an excursion, rather like a quick trip to observe. And then they realize they're in the wrong dimension, and very quickly they head back to from where they emanated. I'm going to go to sci-fi to make that seems to be the most plausible description of that incident.
Yeah, that Sagan in his Cosmos series talked about the possibility of high atmospheric life forms on, I think, Jupiter. The same concept that maybe the core of those giant planets is too hostile for life, maybe. But in the atmosphere, you might have all of the chemical requirements for life, plus the energy. So it's really intriguing. It would be wonderful if we could find some kind of life. I don't even care if it's intelligent, just any kind of other self-replicating, self-organizing sort of molecules in our solar system outside of just DNA. You know, I'd like to believe that there's other possible molecules that could also, you know, contain information and replicate. That'd be great.
It would be, if we could just know that. It would move the discussion and the subject on so wildly. It really would. And the way you were describing there, those certain areas of Jupiter being discovered on Venus, maybe there are these localized Goldilocks zones on otherwise very hostile worlds.
Have you had a lot of people contact you and tell you their thoughts about the book and how much they love the book? Have you had a lot of contact with readers?
Yes, indeed. It's wonderful. I feel I've been welcomed in by a whole new community speaking to you now, for example. Yes. This is a wonderful part of this. I've done the Folklore podcast as well.
Oh, we'd like them. Yep.
Yeah, they're good neighbours. Wonderful. Just people who have this like-minded curiosity, sense of discovery. And just we love to put our minds together on this subject. And there's something so rewarding about doing that. So, yes, I've been delighted by the number of people who've come forward and been so welcoming, and to have the chance to have discussions such as we're having now.
Yeah.
So I'm very grateful for that, yeah.
It's wonderful to see the ongoing popularity of these books, both the Ghost Book and the UFOs book. You know, you'd think that they would be seen as dated nowadays, but no, they've really lasted for decades.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it, isn't it? That they haven't dated at all, and I think that's the wisdom with which they were written and the tone that was taken. It wasn't sensationalist; it was really rooted in that scientific plausibility and with a healthy curiosity. And in a very fast-moving, more flimsy, selfie-taking world now, it's lovely to have that sensibility and to see to what extent it hasn't dated. We still need to be thinking in these ways.
Well, it's intriguing to me, too, but this is a snapshot in time, because this comes out in 77, and the Roswell case has been dormant and won't come back out until like the very early 1980s. So Stanton Friedman and a few other people are involved in bringing that case out. And so that's what really relaunches the sort of paranoia and dark conspiracy theory of cover-up sort of narratives. And so you're in this really interesting spot here in history where there's a sense of wonder and asking questions, but there isn't that overall sense that everything's being suppressed. And now I think the sort of the cultural narrative around UFOs is it seems a lot darker in tone. And I kind of miss this sort of wondrous, curious,
lighthearted
approach. Yeah, it was a simpler time.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. It's very much like that. It seems almost less commercialized, perhaps, to think of that term.
Yes.
We've kind of touched upon this a little bit already, but we've got a few final questions to ask you, John. Of all of them, which do you think would be your favourite?
I love the Betty and Barney Hill case. You know, that they were an ordinary couple. They weren't seeking any notoriety. They just wanted a quiet life. The last thing they would have wanted to do is to speak up and create such notoriety as describing a UFO encounter. Mm-hmm. But I'm intrigued by the description of supposedly there she was on board that alien craft and observing the star map, where there were solid lines between some stars and dotted lines between others. And under hypnosis, she recalled this, and it related to a real star system. And Zeta Reticuli, as I recall, the lines between the various stars. One of them was the sun, And the line to the sun was a solid line, meaning it was a trade route. And the others were dotted lines, which were just observational and exploratory. So imagine that, the sun and our solar system is some kind of a trade route, maybe the material on the moon or on Mars, which is just a little out of sight of human observation. But that always stands very strongly as a most intriguing case. So, yeah, Betty and Barney Hill, I would speak of.
Yeah, we did an episode on the topic going back a few months ago.
So yeah.
It's definitely a classic case.
I was going to say, do you listen to podcasts by any chance? I don't know if they're part of your audio experience normally.
Yes, I'm learning about them much more. I'm getting rather used to them. They are. It's so wonderful that anybody can do their own podcast, and it's the audience who judge which ones they go to. You know, it doesn't now need some program commissioner in an office to say it's okay.
Right.
Make something and the audience will come if it's if it's any good, you know. And that's I do love listening to them, and it's something I'm discovering more and more.
It feels like a strange sort of verification of Andy Warhol's "In the future, everybody will be famous for 15 minutes." It's like, well, at least everybody will have a
whether
podcast,
they deserve it,
right?
Or not.
Yes.
But I was gonna, we talked to the host of a show called Strange Arrivals, and
that's a great title already.
Oh, it's totally really cool. Good. It's a really, really deep dive into the Betty and Barney Hill story, and I think I feel like, as someone who's been looking into this stuff for pretty much my whole life, I was surprised to actually learn a few new things there. So I highly recommend you check that out if you are interested. Strange Arrivals.
I will. There was another couple of stories which I love as well. Great fondness for. A 1977 BBC documentary called Out of This World. And there was a wonderful couple of characters there called Mrs. Joyce Bowles and the family friend Ted Pratt. And they minister, where they turned down a quieter road on the way back to their home village and were confronted by a soft orange light on a craft which had landed on a verge. This then immobilized their car, a small mini clubman, and emerging from this craft was a tall, almost like a Nordic alien, with piercing pink eyes, she described. He had very piercing pink eyes and sideburns. This creature walked towards my car, put its hand on my roof, and looked in. And I could, the sincerity with which they described what they had seen. And I had a call from a man from London who told me I am to say nothing about this. Well, this is England and this is a free country and I will say what I like. I love their spiritedness. And there was another lady called Jessie Rostenberg. Once again, she spoke in this manner. A very sort of salt-of-the-earth, genuine person. And she saw a craft above the family farmhouse, which contained some of those Nordic aliens looking down on her. And she described them, hair like the old kings. Their faces were full of compassion. And they were very beautiful people. And I was frozen to the spot, but they looked at me with compassion. And then I looked away at my children, and when I looked back, and it was gone. And I saw it shortly after. It orbited our house, it circled our house three times and shut off, and it was gone. And this is something that happened to me, and there it is. Beautifully bizarre. I'd love to see something like that, but the sincerity with which she described it, that's what they're worth looking up. Out of This World, that BBC documentary of 1977.
Oh, I've written it down. I'm definitely going to see if I can find it. I'm an obsessive collector of this sort of material. So,
but I'm very impressed with that, John. You could do your own radio show.
Yes, I love the interview with a fellow called Gordon Crichton on there as well, an ex-diplomat, very intelligent fellow, knew about 10 or 11 languages, and he became sort of a UFO investigator and UFO expert. He spoke about the Hopkinsville goblins and the Argentina alien, the 7-foot-tall one in a car factory. He touched on the idea that these things could be coming from other realities, other dimensions that we can't understand and can't measure. And he had a very sort of efficient military way about speaking. And he says, yes, I do think things are covered up, and I think very wisely. I don't think this is something that you can bring to the attention of everybody. I think if many people knew what I know about this subject, that they might be very alarmed. Very alarmed indeed.
Oh, so he's just like Doctor Who's Brigadier. What?
Yes, exactly. Yes, Gordon Crichton. Yes, very learned fellow. Yes, I think UNIT has tried to make him work for us on a number of occasions. Yes, he was just like the Brigadier or just like a Quatermass character. But the seriousness with which he spoke, fascinating. It's a delicious, delicious world.
Mm-hmm. It sounds it. I'm a very big fan of Quatermass and of Nigel Neal's work in general. So, yeah, that's. Are you when you think of Quatermass, are you thinking of just in general all of them, or is there a particular one you like the most?
I think generally, yes. I think just the atmosphere that it creates, even before a word is spoken, it's just the way that it gives you that sense of psychological fear and alertness, even before anything just gets going. And so much of that fear created by not what you see, but what you don't see. Right. I love the universe of Quatermass and the John Pertwee era of Doctor Who as well. Some of those stories are Inferno and Spearhead from Space. Yes, I also love to take on the guise of John Pertwee. I think if I saw a really good UFO, I think to myself I would pretend to be John Pertwee's Doctor Who. I would think, how would he respond to this? How would he handle it? With great intelligence and great efficiency and a great degree of control. I'm sure that's what would take over my imagination.
Either that or Wurzel Gummidge, right? What?
Don't you be coming in bed there by the ear, miss, eh? You go back to the Zeta Reticulatus. Rooks, I scare away the aliens as well, sir.
Oh, we got 10 people for the price of one.
All right, so we're going to spring something on you.
So, John, this show is Monster Talk, so we talk about all different kinds of monsters, and we have a signature question that we like to ask all of our guests just to close the show, and that is, what's your favourite monster?
Favourite monster. I have to say, I think that 1969 cine film of a Bigfoot walking across the Californian forest, where a loaded cine camera.
Mm-hmm.
That is wonderful. I remember seeing that on Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World and thinking, wow, that was incredible. Now, I don't know whether I was having a chat with Brian Blessed some months ago, and we were talking about this, and he said, oh, yes, yes. Now, I don't know whether he was just joking about it, but he said, oh, yes, 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 that was the wife of one of the horseman, one of the forestry fellows. There she is. Brian Blessed. I don't know whether Brian Blessed was just being mischievous. But I think I would have to say the Sasquatch at the edge of that Californian pine forest. Intriguing.
Bigfoot is definitely one of our go-to. He's one of our signature monsters. I mean, he comes up on here all the time.
And the Patterson-Gimlin footage.
Absolutely. Wow, Brian Blessed, I would have thought he would have more to say about the Yeti with his mountain climbing experience. He's such an interesting character.
Yes, and his beard. He did talk about that. Yeah, exactly. Yes, and full of volume. That was another conversation. I say it, people. People give me £20 and I say it for people's birthdays now. He did actually talk about, we were on a show over here. It's a bit like The View. It's called Loose Women. It's a talk show. And there was one episode some years ago where Brian Blessed and I were guests. And he did, in fact, allude to some of the mountaineering he's done. And he'd seen some of the Alma Yeti-type creatures. And he said, they can be very bad tempered, a very tall, bellowing creature. Great deal of facial hair, bright red. And what a mad look in the eye. Intriguing creature. And I thought, Brian, was that just you?
perhaps looking in your shaving mirror.
Yeah.
He's describing himself. What in the world? I caught my wife at the store today. We're walking down the aisle, and I said, "Ooh, look at that pretty lady!" And she swirled around to see who, like angrily, who is she? And it was we were walking past mirrors. That lovely moment where she goes from anger and jealousy to and that was kind of sweet. You know, he's also kind of an idiot, but.
Making me think of other favourite monsters now as well. I love that. It's one of the real scary, chilling YouTube clips. I don't know whether these creatures are called the Rake, where there are these fellows just stomping through a forest with a camera going, and all of a sudden they see the reflected eyes and this sort of silvery creature bent over, very spindly thing in some sort of bizarre yoga position. And it looks at them very quickly, and those eyes flash, and they just they run very, very quickly.
Ooh,
that's an intriguing one. That's a very intriguing one.
It is. I don't think I've seen that one. I've seen I'll look it up. Yeah,
it's probably just sort of forest alien or something that will take you into there.
For us, you know, we're a very skeptical, science-oriented show. We typically use monsters as sort of a springboard to talk about science topics. But we also like to just like try to solve mysteries if we can. And it's really hard to, I think after doing this for decades, to just sort of sit back and enjoy some internet creepiness, you know, we're always like, wait, how did they do that? It's constantly deconstructing.
Always asking questions.
So, but every now and then I get a good one, you know, or it'll be late at night and I'm just sort of surfing around and I come across something like that. And it's just so wonderful to still be able to feel creeped out, you know?
Yes, I think we enjoy it I think we are testing ourselves. We're perhaps testing our own fight or flight system, and because we like to be in front of something that's frightening to us, but we know we can handle it. The safety net is there because it's just an internet clip. I think you give yourself give your bravery a test run by watching these things. I think people who enjoy horror films, it's a similar thing.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yep. We need to wind up, but I wanted to say, where can people find you? Like, what's the best way to engage with your work?
I do quite a lot of work with Big Finish Productions, who do all of the Doctor Who audio adventures.
Ooh.
And, I play the Brigadier and Dead Ringers on the BBC, the topical comedy show. We've got a series of that coming through in December. And we wonder which political characters will be going along then.
Right,
Or my own Twitter feed at John Coleshaw. I like to occasionally I'll put a few things on there. I don't do a great deal of social media because it slightly drives me mad. If you can just throw off the addictive sense, you know.
Uh huh. For sure.
but now and again I'll pop something on there or have a quick look. So, yes, Big Finish, Deadbringers, and my own Twitter feed, I suppose.
Well, fantastic. Well, we'll put links to all that in the show notes. Yep.
Yeah, and thank you for coming on the show, John. And it was really fun to hear more about the book through your eyes. And I hope that you get to see a UFO one day.
Oh, my goodness. I hope I can come back on the show here and talk about it. But thank you. What a pleasure to speak to you all. And thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure talking to all of you.
Thank you very much for your time.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an interview with entertainer John Coleshaw and the voices of lots of others discussing the children's book UFOs by Usborne, which was part of their World of the Unknown series. Thank you so much to John and all his friends for taking the time to talk with us today about this beautiful and thought-provoking children's book. We have lots more coming up soon because Karen and I have been hitting the microphones to discuss Caribbean tombs, paranormal Bigfoot, the Amityville case, and so much more, so stay tuned. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show. all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk's theme music is by Pete Stealing Monkeys. As always, thanks for listening. Thanks for your reviews and feedback. And thank you for sharing this show with others.
This has been a Monster House presentation.
You're not fit yet.
Not fit. I'm the doctor.
No, doctor. I'm the doctor, and I say that you're not fit.
You may be a doctor, but I'm the doctor. The definite article, you might say.
Look here, doctor. You're not fit.
Not fit. Not fit. Of course I'm fit. All systems go.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.